Hi, I'm Clay Risen, the author of the new book, Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. In my day job as a reporter for the New York Times, I write obituaries. These are, in a way, mini biographies about famous and not so famous people, as well as histories of the world they lived in and how they changed it. Writing obituaries is great training for my other passion, which is writing about American history. I've written books about the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, the fight to pass the Civil Rights Act, and Theodore Roosevelt's campaign with the Rough Riders in Cuba. In my latest book, Red Scare, I examine the era of anti-communist hysteria between roughly 1946 and 1957. I try to present a clear narrative about a confusing moment in time while showing, without telling, why it remains relevant today. There's a lot to take away from the book, but here are five useful points. Point number one, the Red Scare was about much more than just Joe McCarthy. Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin became famous with his witch hunts and wild allegations about Soviet spies embedded in the U.S. government, so much so that his associated ism is synonymous with the Red Scare era. But in fact, the Red Scare started long before McCarthy launched his anti-communist campaign in 1950. 3 years earlier, the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, held hearings on allegations of communism in Hollywood, sending 10 witnesses to prison for contempt, and setting in motion a blacklist in the film industry. Around the same time, President Harry S. Truman initiated a loyalty program that investigated millions of federal workers. Across the country, anti-communist grassroots groups were popping up, and some targeted teachers suspected of harboring progressive ideas, while others protested movies featuring actors accused of pro-communist sentiments. McCarthy was more of a symptom than a cause of the Red Scare. He's important because he perfected the methods of insinuation, guilt by association, and media manipulation that defined the Red Scare era. But his story is not the whole story. Point number two, the Red Scare was a culture war. In 1949, the famed British correspondent Alistair Cook parked himself in the New York courtroom where Alger Hiss, a State Department official accused of espionage, was on trial. He filed regular dispatches for his newspaper back home, the Manchester Guardian, and later wrote a book about the case, which he called A Generation on Trial. What he meant was that whatever the merits of the Hiss case, it also had to be understood as part of a conflict between the progressive ideals of the 1930s, the heyday of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, and a reinvigorated conservatism that was using the specter of communist subversion to push back at Roosevelt's gains. And that's pretty much how the era played out. The Red Scare was supposedly about communist subversion, but thousands of people who had never been communists and had merely, say, signed an anti-fascist petition or raised money for civil rights groups, were targeted as subversives. Hollywood stars, who had once stumped for left-wing causes, suddenly found themselves blacklisted. And thousands of federal workers found themselves out of jobs simply because, a decade earlier, they had signed their name to the wrong list or maybe given a little money to the wrong group. The Red Scare represented a sharp rightward turn in American life, and its victims were those who didn't turn quickly enough. Point number three. The Red Scare was a witch hunt, but that doesn't mean there were no witches. They say that just because a person is paranoid, that doesn't mean that someone isn't out to get them. Something similar applies to the Red Scare. There really were pro-Soviet spies working in the U.S. government. And the American Communist Party really did take orders from Moscow. Today, we can say confidently that Alger Hiss and Julius Rosenberg really did pass secrets to the Soviet Union. Especially with the onset of the Cold War, there was a very good reason for the federal government to pay more attention to the possibility of Soviet spies within its ranks. But there are two important caveats. The first is that so much of the Red Scare took place outside the realm of national security. It's one thing for the FBI to have stepped up background checks on nuclear researchers, which it did. But in Hollywood, the screenwriter Dalton Trumbo was imprisoned and blacklisted simply because he had once, very briefly, joined the Communist Party. Hardly a threat to American welfare. And in many states, getting any sort of official license, even something as mundane as a hairdresser or an undertaker, required taking a loyalty oath. The point of the Red Scare is not that there was no threat, but that the reaction to the threat that was there was so overwhelming and out of proportion. The second caveat is that by the time the Red Scare started after World War II, almost all Soviet spying had stopped. The Soviets had shut down most of their operations, in part because they simply weren't creating returns. They weren't providing the information that they had hoped for. The irony is that while the Soviets were spying on the United States, the government looked the other way during World War II. By the time politicians and the public began hunting for spies, there was hardly anyone left to find. Point number four, gay men were prime targets of the Red Scare. During what was called the Lavender Scare, an era that roughly overlaps with the Red Scare, politicians and federal officials purged hundreds of gay men from the United States government under the pretext that these men were untrustworthy and that they were vulnerable to blackmail by the Soviet Union. It was a ridiculous accusation, rooted in the rampant homophobia of the era. Though there were thousands of gay men working in Washington at the beginning of the Cold War, those at the State Department were especially vulnerable. Conservative senators and commentators on the right liked to deride diplomats as somehow less than masculine, tossing around double entendres about pinkos undermining American interests. It should go without saying that not a single victim of the anti-gay purge, the Lavender Scare, was ever found to be a subversive. The result was a double tragedy. Not only did the Lavender Scare ruin the lives of hundreds of loyal Americans, but also many of those same men were serving on the diplomatic front lines of the Cold War. They were, in a way, Cold Warriors. Removing them was the real assault on American security. Point number five, the Red Scare is still with us. The Red Scare petered out by the mid-1950s, thanks to the end of the Korean War, the death of Joseph Stalin, and the lack of any real evidence of subversion among the American left. But the scars of the Red Scare remained, the traces. It put in place a deep skepticism among millions of Americans about the federal bureaucracy. To some, it was simply out of touch with most Americans. A big, lumbering organization far away that got its hands into places where it didn't belong. But to many, it was a positively evil force, a cabal of un-American elites who answered to a foreign ideology. For decades, that conspiratorial sentiment remained on the fringes, but it occasionally surfaced among hard-right insurgencies into the mainstream. We see it today, perhaps more forcefully than at any time since the 1950s, when politicians today talk about the deep state or about Marxist elites. They're drawing on the same wellspring of conspiracy mongering that drove the Red Scare. Such thinking has become endemic in American life and can no longer be dismissed as merely the fringe of the fringe. Put differently, in order to understand where we are today, we have to understand the Red Scare. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy reading the book as much as I enjoyed writing it.